So this is a time for any questions or comments about the practice. It's just an open discussion time. Anything you'd like to discuss? So the question was, how do you work with doubt? That she's surprised that she's been practicing for some time now and doubt is still arising. First, to understand that that is one of the hindrances the Buddha mentioned. Of the five hindrances, doubt is one of them, and it's very common. So you shouldn't be surprised that it's arising. First, I would try to see what the doubt is about, because it could be doubt about the practice. You know, we're sitting here watching the breath. What for? You know, so that's a kind of doubt. What am I doing here? It could be doubt about the teachers. You know, you have all these different people come through and they maybe say the same thing, maybe say different things. You know, so you begin to have some questions or doubt. Very commonly, it's self-doubt. You know, maybe there is a confidence in the practice and a basic appreciation of the teachers, but there can be, I can't do it. It's too hard. You know, this isn't the right time. So first thing I would try to see is, you know, what the doubt is saying. It becomes easy to work with it when we become mindful that it's present. If the doubt is there and we're simply lost in the doubting tape, so then it's very hard to extricate oneself. And it's particularly hard because the voice of doubt sounds like the voice of reason. So it's a very wise-sounding voice. And it tricks us. And because it sounds like that, we very often are not mindful. We're not recognizing, oh, this is the doubting tape. We're not seeing it for what it is. It's coming disguised. So if you've noticed, and already, you know, you've kind of made progress in your practice because you've noticed that the doubt is there, I would be very attentive, very aware, just as that doubting voice, that doubting tape starts in the mind, name it. Oh, this is doubt, doubt, doubt. And then it's simply the same practice as we would do with any other thought. Are we lost in the thought, or are we aware that the thought is there? So if the doubting tape is there and you're aware of it as doubt, you're simply recognizing it, you're mindful of it, you're noting it, you're noticing it. It comes and goes like every other thought, and you're not believing it, you're not condemning it, you're not judging yourself for having it. It's really no different than a passing sound. But as I say, it's particularly seductive because it comes masquerading as wisdom. So that's really the key point. You know, to see it for what it is. And just as maybe a secondary thought on it, if there are doubts about the practice or the teachings, often it's very good to clarify them, you know, to speak to somebody and give voice to them and say, you know, I have these questions, this doesn't quite make sense, you know, can you help me understand it?
Pointing out the nature of mind, which you did, and I appreciate it greatly, was kept as the greatest secret for thousands of years, and you just did it for us in the last half hour. Could you talk a little bit about the difference between, you know, how we do it. Maybe America is a great place, and, you know, there's a real can-do attitude. I don't know, but could you talk about that a little bit?
Okay, so did everybody hear the question? Okay, the question was about, in the last part of the meditation, he was saying that, you know, I was pointing out kind of the nature of awareness, the nature of mind. In some traditions, that kind of teaching is kept secret, you know, and it's only given under very special circumstances, and yet here it's just put out like that. And so could I say something about that? First, it's to understand that what you're referring to in terms of kind of the pointing out of the nature of mind in that context, at least to the extent that I'm aware of, is really in the Tibetan tradition, particularly in the Dzogchen lineages, where it's held as, you know, a very special teaching given under special circumstances. I wouldn't confuse this with the whole body of Dzogchen teachings. And that's with, so this is just a very specific kind of looking at the nature of the mind, which is found in many traditions. In Dzogchen, and I'm not at all a Dzogchen master or qualified, you know, in that tradition. And so within that tradition, this is part of a much more elaborate preparation and understanding. So that's all. I would just make that distinction. This pointing to the nature of awareness in this more limited way of just really looking at the mind is found in many traditions. It's not limited to Tibetan or Dzogchen. There are many Zen stories, you know, where the Zen master is just pointing directly at the nature of awareness. And in Theravada, it's also there are teachings. Yeah. So again, within each, it's important to honor the context of each tradition. You know, as.
I'm a new person, and sometimes I can't tell if I'm awake or I'm asleep.
I'm an old person. Sometimes it's hard to tell. One technique that you might use, and sometimes this is a technique of practice that some teachers emphasize, some don't, but it would be particularly useful in a situation like that, is the tool or the method of mental noting, which is just that very soft mental label for what's happening. So, for example, with a breath, one might note very softly, like a whisper in the mind, a silent word, in, out, hearing, thinking, pressure, in, out. In the situation you describe, if you are able to note what's happening, you're awake. it's a good feedback.
Thank you.
Okay, so the question and comment was that he's had some experience of emptiness and has recently met other people who seem to have had that experience. Yeah. Is there any special thing to do with that or training to do with it? And then also recently, if I understood you correctly, had an experience of Mara, or Mara is the embodiment of illusion, right? And so how does that all fit together? And would it be helpful to speak to somebody about that? Without going into too much detail, now I think it would be good to speak to a teacher one-on-one and really explain exactly what's happening in your experience and just to get some guidance. I don't know if there's anything you could say just briefly about what you mean by the experience of emptiness. What is vanishing? Just in terms of seeing things and you're looking at things and things vanishing? I'll back up a little bit. The term emptiness in Buddhism, it's a translation of the Pali and Sanskrit word shunyata, and it's a very rich term. And emptiness in English doesn't really do it justice, and it's often misunderstood. So shunyata can mean many different things. In Theravada Buddhism, Vipassana tradition, it's really a synonym for selflessness, although in other traditions it can have other meanings as well. One of the ways we experience emptiness, selflessness, shunyata, one of the doorways into that experience is through a very refined perception of change. Because when the mind starts being aware on a very momentary level of things arising and passing, very quick. It's what I call NPMs, which are noticings per minute. You know? And the NPMs in meditation can go way up. You know, at first maybe it's 10 NPMs, you know, or 20 or 30, and it can be 100, it could be 1,000. You know, the mind can get very, very quick. So at that time in practice, when we're perceiving very rapidly, sometimes we're at a place where we're just seeing things dissolving. You know, and so that's really the seeing of impermanence on a very refined level. At that level of perception, we see nothing is lasting long enough to be self. Right? Because everything is changing, it's dissolving so quickly. And so we begin to really have an immediate direct experience of the selfless nature of this whole process. It's just a mind-body process happening very, very quickly. But because our perception is not usually that refined, we're not seeing the change so quickly. It's like going to a movie theater, you know, and the frames of the film is really, it's just frames of film. I don't know if this is still how they show films, but... is it? I don't know. I don't really know. But in the old days, anyway, there was, you know, frames of film moving very quickly. And so we don't see the separate frames, right? We see a continuity. Well, our life is like that. It's actually separate frames, moments of consciousness, moment after moment, but so quickly we don't see it. You know, and so we feel it as a continuity, as a self. So what you're describing really is breaking through that illusion of continuity. So that's one meaning of selflessness. Another meaning of it, of shunyata, is the ungovernable nature of things, meaning that everything arises out of the appropriate causes and conditions, not because we want them or not want them to be a certain way. We can have the strongest desire in the world for a cup of tea, but if you don't put the kettle on and bring the water to a boil, it's not going to happen. That's what ungovernable means. It doesn't mean that we can't understand the laws, but that things are following laws. They're not just following our wishes. Now I'm going to go a little political. Just imagine the difference the world would be if people understood that desired results come about when the appropriate causes and conditions are there, rather than come about because we wish them to be there. It would be a big difference, but we'll leave that aside. So, going back to Mara, what was the experience of Mara? Growing what? A kind of energy that what? Okay, so he's describing, I was asking what his experience of Mara, this embodiment of illusion, was, and he just was describing it as a kind of very ambiguous but seductive energy. First, to know that there is a huge, huge range of energetic phenomena that can happen, both in the world externally and in our own mind-body process. There's just, we're living generally in a very narrow range of perception. You know, and as the mind gets quieter and more still and more concentrated, we just open up to just a huge range of phenomena. Mara, or illusion, is not in what happens. It's, if we want to use that term, Mara, it's really in our relationship to what happens, right? And so there could be very unusual energetic phenomena, and if you are staying aware and mindful of it, then you're resting in wisdom. No matter what the energy is, what the object is, that doesn't really matter, if you are staying mindful of it. The problem is that very often different kinds of energy or very ordinary experiences become seductive. We get pulled into them, and that's Mara. That's when we're getting caught. That's when we're getting identified. And we see it happen countless times a day with different thoughts that arise in the mind. Our thought arises, we're not aware that it's there, we're lost in it. I mean, I've talked, you know, recently and at the retreat up at Hollyhock a lot about the importance of becoming aware of and investigating the nature of thought. Because thought is an incredibly interesting and potentially and actually powerful force in our lives. Mostly we are slaves of our thoughts. We're like these little slaves. And thoughts are saying, go here, go there, do this, do that. I think I'll have a pizza. No. And we're just running around. It's like we're running around obeying our thoughts. Now, it's so interesting, and it's really interesting, and this is one of the great gifts of meditation, is that when there's some degree of mindfulness, when we're beginning to pay attention to our minds, become aware of what's arising, and we see the thought arising in the mind, we're aware that we're thinking, the most amazing thing happens. We see that the thought itself has no power at all. The thought itself is little more than nothing. It's just this little blip in the mind. You know, it's just the only power thoughts have is the power we give them. So, what are we doing? Why are we giving them all this power and having them drive us crazy? They're just a momentary arising. Except they're so slippery. You know, they just slip right in. We don't know that they're there. We get seduced by them. We get lost in the story it's telling us. And then somewhere down the road, we wake up. Right? Oh, that was just a thought. So just pay attention, both in your sitting practice, but in the course of your day. How much of the day is spent lost in thought? Lost in the stories we're telling ourselves, about other people, about our experience, about what's happening. And we don't know that we're thinking. It's like we're lost in it. That's really Mara. You know? But there's good news. Because as many times as we're lost, exactly that many times do we wake up from being lost. Right? At a certain point, we're gone, 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 and then at a certain point, oh, I've been thinking. Don't ignore that moment. Usually we just pass right over that moment. We're not paying attention to it. That moment is a moment of awakening. That moment is revealing the nature of awareness. So delight in it. Every time you come out from being lost in a thought, smile. Because we've gone from being deluded, from being under the sway of Mara, to being awake. Does this seem clear?
Yeah.
Because, okay. Yeah.
That could be very crucial information.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So how do we discern the difference between waking up to the fact that we're thinking, but also discerning, is this thought useful? Is it helpful? Is there useful information? Or do I have to act on it? That's really important. That discernment is not aided by being lost in the thought. When we're lost in the thought, basically we are going to be responding to it out of long habituated reactions. The thought's there, and whatever our habit is around the thought, that's what we're going to do because we don't know that we're thinking. When you become aware of the thought, you can hold the thought. It doesn't mean that the thought needs to disappear. And then you can discern, oh, is this skillful? Is it unskillful? Do I need to do something here or not? So just as an example, in this context right now, you know, in the Buddhist teachings, both speaking the Dharma and listening to the Dharma is listed. There are a million lists in Buddhism. But both speaking to and listening to the Dharma is listed as meditation. You know, it's not listed as study. It's meditation. But it's a special kind both of speaking and listening. So when we're hearing the Dharma, it's not that helpful to ruminate about it or to get involved in an internal dialogue with it. Rather, to whatever extent the words are pointing to something, to actually look to where the words are pointing. You know, when we listen in that way, that's why in the Buddhist time, many people got enlightened just listening to the Buddha teaching. Didn't have to go to meditation courses, didn't just listen to. So, for example, here's a chance to get enlightened. This is one of my favorite Zen dialogues. You have to listen in the right way, though. It's not listening and kind of thinking, oh, that's clever, you know, or that's funny, or, you know, look. It's really listening and doing what the dialogue is saying. You know, so this is a direct pointing. Okay, most of you are probably familiar with Bodhidharma, you know, the figure who brought traditionally Buddhism from India to China. And he was this very fierce old Zen master, you know, and he said he sat in a cave for 7 years facing the back wall, you know, just hardcore meditator. So this guy comes in China, you know, and he's been searching. He's just been searching all over for somebody to teach him. You know, he's very distressed. He's suffering a lot. He hears of Bodhidharma. He comes to Bodhidharma, and he says, "Sir, please teach me. I'm suffering so much. Please pacify my mind." And Bodhidharma said, "No, you know, we came here. It's not. Doesn't happen in words. You know, don't bother me." But the guy's very persistent. You know, I'm really in distress. Please pacify my mind." So Bodhidharma says, "Show me your mind, present me your mind, and I'll pacify it." And the guy says, "I've looked for it everywhere." Now listen to this. "I've looked for the mind everywhere. So look. I've looked for the mind everywhere. You know, is it there? Is it there? Is it there? Is it there? I've looked for the mind everywhere. And I can't find it." And Bodhidharma says, "There, it's already pacified. Looking for the mind, not finding it, not seeing it as a substantial thing to find. Look for the mind, can't find it. There, it's already pacified." So that's how we should listen. You know, when we're hearing the Dharma, it's always to do it, not to do the words, not to think about them. So, already pacified. It's only 10 to 8. Could you hear?
No.
Okay, he said that he comes out of a spiritual tradition of deity worship, only recently coming to Buddhism with these teachings, but somewhat ironically he finds that the deity, for whatever that is, he finds more accessible in this practice than in the more ostensible deity worship practice. And would I comment on that? I think one of the problems is that there are certain words in English that are just used in so many different ways, like God, like deity, you know. And so really to have a dialogue about that would mean clarifying exactly what is meant by that term. And when we're talking about God or deity, that's no easy task. But if we're using the term, then it's worth reflecting, some deep reflection on, at least for ourselves, what do I mean by that term? However we understand it, we should be clear about how we're using it. Otherwise, any conversation is going to be very confused, right? If we don't know how we're using the word. But to perhaps address a little bit your question, quite a few years ago I was at a Buddhist Christian conference, and it was held at Gethsemane Abbey in Kentucky, which is where Thomas Merton lived for many years. And it was a conference of 25 Catholics, and quite senior and liberal, and 25 Buddhists, and among His Holiness the Dalai Lama was there as well. You know, so it's a very engaging conference, and I found something really interesting about it. Actually, two things really stand out. One is that when the dialogue tended towards theology, there were a lot of differences. I mean, just the metaphysics are really different. So the theological discussions, that was just like, didn't seem really to go anyplace. But when people were talking about values, there was a huge amount in common. You know, the values of peace, the values of love, the values of compassion, the values of non-harming, the values of selflessness. You know, so that was interesting to me, that when we drop down from the metaphysics to, okay, what's actually being developed, there's a lot in common. It's not to say that the traditions are the same, or necessarily even that they go to the same place. I don't know. You know, and we'd have to get to the end of each one to assess that. But at least in some big area of our common experience, a lot of the values are shared. And that may be one of the things you're opening to. You know, you're really opening to that arena of openness, of spaciousness, of love. Okay, this is just a little vignette from that conference. And it was one of the most moving things to me. The abbot of Gethsemane was giving the closing remarks, you know, at the end of the conference. So this was, you know, there had been a lot of discussion back and forth. And he said that for him, the most moving moment of the conference was one day as we were all leaving the chapter house, you know, and there was this long kind of corridor, it's a beautiful monastery, and at one end of the hallway there was a statue of the Virgin Mary. And one day the abbot had come out, but in front of him, His Holiness the Dalai Lama had come out first. And so the abbot was just describing that he was watching the Dalai Lama walk down the hall, stop in front of the statue of the Virgin Mary, and bow. I get tears in my eyes now just thinking of it. You know, I'm not Catholic. But it just represents to me, and I think it was particularly moving to me, because it's something I don't think in a million years I would have thought to do. You know, it was not... It was not in my frame of reference. Of course, that's why the Dalai Lama is the Dalai Lama. Yeah, and it's just that sense of not getting caught in attachment to the differences, but just honoring what's of value. What's of value universally. You know, and it's beautiful. And so it can be found any place, and we each find our own way to it.
I see the mind going crazy, being critical, analyzing, but then I also see the mind, the awareness or whatever it is, turning it around. And it takes, and I feel that it still takes the mind also to see that. Look where you're going. What is this? I understand. So the thing about the mind disappearing, little difficult to think it just disappears because stuff is going to happen. But maybe the good part of the mind can see the beauty and mistakes and can correct it and turn it around.
Okay, so the comment was, and correct me if I don't have it right, was that she's watched the mind being very critical, very judgmental, but then at a certain point, so the mind's going in that direction, and then at a certain point, another part of the mind becomes aware of that and really can turn it around. And that really sounds to me like the mind of wisdom and awareness, seeing that's not skillful, and going, letting go of it, going another direction. So that all seems perfect. Yes, that is still the mind. It's different aspects of the mind. And then you made a comment about the mind disappearing.
That's what I mean. I don't understand that. You say the mind, look for the mind. It's
not to say so much that it disappears, because, and that's, here we're getting into some subtle problems of subtlety, because to describe in language the nature of mind can be quite difficult. But just to play with it, so keep it in the realm of, we're just kind of playing with the words and trying to get, you know, some hints about it. And here maybe it could be helpful in the Tibetan description of the nature of mind. It's very useful, I think. It describes the nature of mind as the union of clarity or knowing and emptiness. So emptiness means one of the meanings. There are many meanings to it. One of the meanings is it's empty like space. There's nothing to find. And yet space is a phenomena. So it's not that space disappears. Okay, so the mind has a space-like quality, but also the mind is not space. Space doesn't know anything. Right? So the nature of mind is the union of a space-like nature and the knowing capacity. And so maybe you were just putting too much on the word disappear. It's not that there is a nature of mind, and it is the co-joining of these two things, a space-like nature with a knowing capacity.
I feel I still need a bit of a mind to function.
Absolutely.
And to see. Yes. The stuff.
Yes, absolutely. The nature of the mind is to be aware, and it's to be aware of all the things that arise. So don't overload that notion of disappearing, because everything you described sounded right on. So yeah, keep it up.
I would love to hear anything you had to say about love. I'm surprised by the amount of actual terror or fear I had at times. And I'm surprised that I used to long to be alone.
Here it is.
So I want to know both about how to bear that. I know you've been talking about it all the time, but if you could maybe address it particularly to the love and to the aloneness.
Okay, so the comment was, if I could say something about love, and she was saying that for the first time in many years, now she's alone, and during those 30 years would often long for the aloneness, and now that she is alone, feeling a lot of terror come up about it. And so just to speak about all that. I'll preface it by saying this is not going to be a comprehensive answer. on the nature of love. So it'll be a few just tidbits.
That'll be helpful.
Maybe, no, we'll see. For me, I find it much easier to understand it when I think of it in terms of loving rather than love. Because love, and I'm just speaking for myself now, love is a very abstract word. Whereas loving, feeling loving, feels very immediate to me. It's like I know when I'm love. I know when I'm feeling loving. And it reminds me that love, like everything else, is sometimes there and sometimes not there. So instead of creating this notion of love, and that somehow we should have it, it just gets too confusing for me. But when I just reflect, you know, as much as I can through the, am I loving or am I not loving? Realizing that both are going to happen. I'm going to go through these cycles, but that I can practice being loving seems to me a lot easier than practicing love. You know, so it just makes it more down to earth and easier to pay attention to. You know, you're going through the day, you're meeting people, you're loving or not loving. Loving or not loving. So that's one piece. There is a meditation, as you well know, on loving kindness. In that phrase, I find it more helpful in practice to emphasize the kindness rather than the love. Because again, to me, it's just more down to earth. Am I being kind? Am I not being kind? And the kindness becomes or is the expression of love. But to try to make ourselves love, I don't know, it gets... But to be kind, it's just that I know what that means. You know, I think we all know, am I kind or am I not kind? So this whole question has always been, how can I ground it in experience rather than in some concept that's a beautiful concept? You know, but it's somehow it's easier to feel the reality of it in these very specific ways. So that's one thing. One of the first things my teacher said to me when I first went to India, I was young, I was like, I think I was 20 years old, 21 years old. I mean, it was around there. And my first teacher was Munindraji. And he was this little old guy. He was not at all the archetype of a guru. You know, he was really speedy and kind of bargaining with the local, you know, vendors in the bazaar. But he was really present. And that's what one of the great lessons was to see being present doesn't mean you have to creep along or, you know, be solemn at all. I mean, he was just full of energy and very active and engaged, but he was really present. I don't recall seeing him kind of toppling forward. So one day we were just going for a walk. This was in Bodh Gaya, you know, in the place the Buddha was enlightened. We were just walking back in some of the lanes in the villages. And he said to me, you know, I never feel bored. It's like, I'm friends with the clouds, I'm friends with the flowers, I'm friends with... And at the time, I really didn't know what he was talking about. I didn't. I mean, it sounded nice. But, okay, he's friends with the clouds. But over the years of my practice, I have really deeply come to appreciate that. So I'll just give you an example. When you're listening to music, and you're just with the music, what does the concept alone mean? It doesn't really mean anything. Because all that's happening in that moment, there is an intimacy in that moment of awareness and the sound. It's like there's a genuine intimacy, a becoming one with the sound. Meditation is really the art of intimacy. It is absolutely not dependent on any particular situation or being. It's like, are we being intimate with the experience in the moment? That's why, and this takes some practice, you know, to really settle into it, but it's why people can do walking meditation back and forth for half an hour. I mean, from the outside, lifting, moving, placing. I mean, it's like an insane asylum. It just seems like the most incredibly boring, lonely. Yet, when we're in the practice, and the mind is right there, is one with the movement, there is an intimacy of experience there where absolutely nothing is lacking. Nothing. Because the whole idea of self or other or alone or together, it completely falls away. That's what I think Munindraji meant. You know, he was so present. He was friends with the clouds and with the wind and with the flowers and with other people when they were there, and it didn't matter. You know, it was that intimacy in the moment. So I would look at the trigger point. So now you're in a situation where you're physically not with somebody else. I would watch very carefully for that first thought that triggers the whole story of I'm alone, I'm terrified, it's just a story. It's just a story. You know? But it's a very seductive story. Now, but that's okay, lots of things are seductive. It is harder to extricate yourself once you're really in it. I'll tell you another practice story. Years ago, this may be, I don't know, 15 years ago, so had a really hard retreat, the worst. It was my body was a mess. It was just, my back was, just the body was a mess. And then I did something which made it worse, so then there was all that self-judgment. So my mind was a mess. And this was a 2-month retreat. What? Okay. Where did you lose it? Okay, I was on this retreat, very difficult retreat. Body was a mess, mind was a mess, did something which made it worse, so then there was all that self-judgment. And the 2 months became it was a retreat of anguish. Real anguish. I mean, I was low. I was really low. And then at a certain point, what is going on here? How can I be so caught in this story? Because I was lost in it. So I started looking very carefully at how I was getting so lost. And what I saw was that there was one thought that if I missed, it was such a seductive thought. If I was not mindful of that arising as a thought in my mind, I was gone. And I could have half an hour lost in the story, feeling terrible. So I just put the radar out. I just watch for that thought. So it became like a video game. And it was amazing. It was really, when I caught the thought and saw it as a thought, my mind didn't go down that trail. So it takes a lot of awareness to do that, but I think you probably are quite motivated, because in my situation, and it sounds like in yours, there's a lot of suffering when we get lost in the story. Is this making some sense to you? It's definitely workable. It is, because the nature of experience, in the actual nature of moment-to-moment experience, when we're really present, and this takes practice, which is what we're all doing, we're practicing an intimate level of attention to what's happening, not a half-hearted level of attention. You know, there's a meditative disease which you should watch out for, and I call it more or less mindful. You know, I'm kind of mindful. I'm kind of here. I'm kind of present. It's the meditative disease, because it's not really mindfulness, but it's enough mindful that we think it's mindful. Right? So, okay, we'll just do a little exercise. Now, this exercise has the potential to be the most boring thing in the world or completely absorbing. So just see where you fall on that spectrum. Okay, so let's just move our arms and feel the movement. And you can move it at any speed you like, slow or fast, but really feel it. Feel the subtlety of sensations of the movement. You know, maybe there's a heaviness in the arm, or a tingling, or a pressure, or a throbbing, or a light, something. Just feel it. And feel the changes as you move. I mean, I don't know about you, I could do this for a long time. It's just the mind can be completely engaged. What happens to sense of self there? When we're right there, that's all that's there. You know, so there's not self, there's not other, there's not alone, there's not... So that's what it's about, living like that. And we can. But you need to get good at the video game. Either because it's powerful. It's a powerful story. So you really need to catch the first thought of it.
You use the word thought a number of times. I wonder if, for myself, I find what happens is a feeling attaches itself to the story. So is that also what you just said is also true of paying attention to the feeling as it arises and then before it even jumps in?
Okay, so the question was, in talking about thought, that for her, there's often a feeling attached to the thought, and do I mean, or am including attention to the feeling before jumping into the story? One of the interesting things to explore is the nature of the relationship between thought and feeling. And feeling here we're using to mean emotion. Right? So what's the relationship between thought and emotion? And it could be different ways. Sometimes a thought, words in the mind, will trigger an emotion. Sometimes there may be an emotion, a nonverbal emotion, which gives rise to thoughts. So it's just to watch. It's just to watch that interplay and to be aware of both. One thing that is exceedingly helpful in terms of being with emotion, because that's a little harder even than being with thought. Because as subtle and slippery as thoughts are, there's a definite beginning, middle, and end. You know, it's like words in the mind. And emotion is much more amorphous, you know, and complex. It's a whole constellation of a certain feeling in the mind and feeling in the body, and so there's a lot going on. Okay, there's a lot I'm sure you're familiar with in terms of working with emotion. One of the key things, of course, is recognizing it, of recognizing that it's there and even what it is. Okay, I'll tell you a recognition story and how important it can be to recognize what it is. You know, for many years I was just teaching, going around the country, didn't have a home, and it was just, you know, sort of on the circuit. And then we started IMS, and I lived in the center. And I lived in the room in the center, for about 13 years. And then when I hit 40, enough. Okay. I just felt, oh, this time, I really like my own space. Of course, I didn't have any money, you know. Okay, 40 years old, having lived in the center, felt I needed a house, didn't know what to do, how am I going to have this happen? So we just, in talking with some friends, we just kind of sent out a letter to about 13, 15 people, you know, just putting it out, seeing what would happen. Miraculously, I mean, this was a total miracle, basically somebody offered to build a house for Sharon and myself, you know, kind of duplex. So this was amazing, totally amazing, right next to IMS. So, and I got very involved in the building, the design, I really involved. So it's built, and it's a very nice house. Finally built, I move in, I start living there by doing a month-long retreat, you know, kind of a self-retreat on my half of the house. And my mind attacked. This house is too nice. Dharma teachers shouldn't be living like this. On and on and on. How can I be living it? I was just nudging myself about this house. I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to move out to a place in the woods. I'm going to give it to the staff. You know, this. So finally, this went on. This was not just in one sitting. So it was just going on and on. So finally, again, I just got interested. What is going on here? How is my mind getting so caught in this little melodrama? So I looked carefully, and I saw that what I was actually feeling, the feeling that was there, was embarrassment. I hadn't recognized it. I just knew there was something that felt uncomfortable. When I recognized the feeling, oh, you're feeling embarrassed. Embarrassment was okay. I could accept the embarrassment. It's a lot easier to feel embarrassed than move out of the house. I since stopped feeling embarrassed. But the point, it was really instructive for me, because until I recognized the emotion, I was unable to accept it. And as long as I was unable to accept it, it kept jabbing. Right? So that recognition of, okay, what is it? You know, and we may have to search a little bit. Sometimes it's immediately obvious, and sometimes not. And we have to, is it anger? Is it sadness? Is it whatever? Once there's the recognition, then we can really be accepting of it. And once we're accepting of it, emotion, like everything else, rises and passes. It washes through. We're not locking it in by non-acceptance. You know? So there's a whole process of working with emotion just that way. Okay, the comment was somewhat related to doubt, and you know, when he looks at the world and the countries that are predominantly Buddhist, at least at the present moment, have very repressive governments. So first, it's just, this is a slice of history, but basically, what's that about? You know, and is there a connection? And I really can't say much about it because I don't know that much about the history. So I'll just say a little bit, but take it with a grain of salt, because I don't feel like I have any great expertise in this. But just my little bit of awareness, not only in Buddhist countries, but in many Asian countries, of the educational system, there's not... Again, this is a very limited understanding, so some of you may know much more about this than I do. But my impression is that just in the very fabric and the culture of the educational system, there's not a lot of emphasis on individual inquiry, investigation. The way kids are taught is very different than here, you know. And I think one of the great things about Western civilization, along with many of its not so great things, but is that spirit of investigation and inquiry, which I think translate to some extent, you know, into some of the cultural forms. So that may be a part of it, you know, but I can't really say more than that. It's not something I've really studied. Yeah. I just want to see. Yeah. Okay, no, so the question was, talk about the mind. How does Buddhism explain the soul? This is a question that's related to an earlier question, you know, about God and deity worship in terms of what is meant by the term soul. You know, so the response to that question would depend on what you mean by soul. So I don't know that you have a meaning at hand. Or I could offer a couple. Right. I think the very best approach is to rest in the unknowing and look, rather than take things on belief, right? Or create a concept in your mind and then struggle with the concept. Soul is not a word that is found particularly in Buddhist teachings, because how it's often used, but not necessarily all the time, but how it's often used is to refer to some unchanging, immaterial self or I that's somehow embedded or is carried. So in the Buddhist teachings, that's not part of it. It said that really what we are calling self or soul is a process, not something unchanging. However, often people, Westerners, would come to Meninja and ask him about the soul, and he would just say, look, really, because the whole process of meditation is investigate. The process of meditation is for you to investigate on as subtle a level as possible, and the tools of practice help you reach those levels of subtlety, investigate the nature of what this life is about. What is this? So that's what I would do. Because otherwise, I mean, people could get into endless debates. There's a soul, there's no soul. May not even know what each other are talking about. And it doesn't go anyplace. It doesn't transform anything, because it's not based... It's just the mind playing out thought. It's not based on personal experience. So I think it's really helpful to see, and this is the great gift of the meditative disciplines, is that it gives us the tools to see for ourselves. And then you'll know.
Mantra after that experience, and I felt a really deep heart opening in his presence, and afterwards it continued, and I just wondered, what is the role of mantras in mindfulness or in meditation? How are they to be used?
Okay, so the question was, she had seen His Holiness the Karmapa on a recent visit, got very connected with the mantra, the Om Mani Padme Hum mantra, and continues to feel very connected to that and heart opening. What's the role of mantra in mindfulness or this meditation practice? It is a kind of meditation, you know, mantra meditation. And it is its own particular method and practice and brings results. So it's different than the mindfulness practice that is aimed at seeing the momentary nature of things. I mean, that's what mindfulness is, to really see moment to moment, the arising and passing away, as, how to say, through the seeing of that, the mind lets go of grasping, because we see this, nothing lasts long enough to grasp. In the letting go of grasping, the mind is free. There are many, many methods to use. That mantra is a mantra of compassion. Right? And so as we do it and compassion grows, if developed in the right way, that greater and greater compassion leads in its own way to selflessness. Right. And so they can be very complementary practices. They're different. I mean, it's a different method. And I'm not saying particularly that they actually, the end point is the same, but I'm saying that they both support the coming to the end point. You know, so I wouldn't see them in conflict. I would just see them as different, supporting each other.
So if I was going to do, it would be better to do both types of meditation in a day, do a certain amount of time of mindfulness, and then if I wanted to do the mantra,
right,
set aside another time.
And so the question was how to do both practices, if feel a connection with both. You could do it in many different ways, but that's a good way. You could do like one session of the Vipassana, one session of mantra. I think that's a good way. Or you could devote a certain period of time to doing one and then doing the other. And there was a time in my practice for over a year where the only practice I did was metta. You know, and then that cycle came to an end and I started doing Vipassana again. So there are different ways, but what you suggested sounds like a fine way.
I've been listening to your voice for 30 years and I've never met or seen you. So it's quite an experience to get the real flesh and blood of you, and I want to thank you for all those tapes and so forth that we've listened to in books and such.
You're welcome.
I haven't practiced as much as you. Find in troubled times now, feeling betrayed and hurt and scared, the benefit is a return to the Dharma. So I'm blessing that, but I'm still very in a lot of pain. And a lot of it is anger versus kindness. And if you could just speak for a moment about your experience with forgiveness, especially when the anger feels so righteous. And it's so stuck. And I'm so right. And yet, the Buddha said that anger is consuming of the host, and kindness is sustaining. And I don't want to continue to hurt myself and others. At the same time, I'm so right.
Okay, so the question was about anger versus kindness. The seductive power of anger and the particular seduction of being right, which, as we all know, kind of feeds the anger. Okay. Little demonstration. Okay. So just, this is a line here. Point A is the situation that happened. Point B is the anger. Before I go on, or at this point, just a line the Buddha said about anger which reflects your own understanding. Anger with its poisoned source and honeyed tip. So he recognized, just as we do, the seductive power of it. So it's good to see that. Okay, point A is the situation. Somebody does something really hurtful, harmful, whatever. Point B is the anger. What happens? Situation, we get angry, we just think about the situation, it makes us more angry. We feed the anger because we're right. We think more about the situation, so we're in a loop. What's the way out? Point A, situation. Point B, the anger. There's a point C. Now, point C is some form of the question, how am I getting hooked by the anger? How am I getting hooked? How am I relating to it? What's my attitude about it? Now, what's freeing about point C is that from point C, A has become irrelevant. A has nothing to do with how we're relating to the anger. Nothing. It's completely irrelevant. So, in fact, just by moving to point C, by taking an interest in our attitude about the anger, we're cutting all those threads of blame, of judgment, of to point A. Because point A is not in the picture anymore. Because we're not feeding that loop, it actually allows for the anger to be there. We're seeing it. We're seeing our attitude. We're investigating how we're getting hooked by it. Like everything else, it washes through because we're not locking it in by tying it to point A. As long as you are going back to A, we just feed it. So, of course, we don't free ourselves from it. So it's not that difficult once you recognize that that's what's happening. Now, one of the things from point C that you will see and have seen is that one of the attitudes that we carry about the anger is self-righteousness. Okay, so then we actually become mindful of the self-righteousness. Right? Rather than just having the self-righteousness feed the loop back to A, we've actually included that in the B and C. Do you follow? This is, I speak from frequent personal experience. We actually can free our minds from this hook. And this is how we do it. That's why it's so empowering, because as long as we're looping back to A, we have given all our power to the world. Which never works, because the world is never going to meet our expectations. So we'll never be free. When we go to point C, that's totally within ourselves. That has nothing to do with the world. So just to close this little piece, one of my all-time favorite lines was, this is years ago, I was in a relationship for some time, and we were having a little disagreement, and I mean, she's now and still a very good friend. In that moment of the heated argument, she looked at me and said, "Stop making me feel aversion." And I really started to laugh. That was not that helpful in the moment. But it was such a perfect line, because it's how generally we live our lives. Stop making me feel this way. As if it's the other person's fault that we're feeling how we feel. And it has nothing to do. I mean, they may be the conditions for an emotion to arise, but how we're relating to that emotion, nothing to do with the other person at all. I see Rodney creeping up from the side. Thank you. This has been great.